I would rather we do," said Mrs. Rowland firmly. "If you believe that I have schemed only because Tremaine is in line for a dukedom, then you are greatly mistaken. Do you think I never came upon the two of you together in the sitting parlour at Brower Meadow, holding hands and whispering? I'd never seen you so alive and happy, before or after. And I'd never seen him that way, completely without his reserve, for once acting his age, when he'd always carried the burden of the world on his shoulders. That was a long time ago, Mother. Not long enough for me to have forgotten. Or you. Or him." Gigi took a deep breath and finished her tea. It was already cold, and too sweet, because Camden's ungloved hand had brushed hers when he passed the secrétaire, and she didn't know two from four in the minute afterward. "What good does it do any of us to remember? I loved him then, I would not deny it, and perhaps he loved me too. But that's all in the past. He no longer loves me, and I no longer love him, and if there are second chances going around, no one has offered me any, least of all Camden." "Don't you see?" cried Mrs. Rowland, exasperated, setting down her teacup with an uncharacteristic thud. A glob of milky brown liquid sloshed over the rim of the cup and spread into an astonishingly perfect circular stain on the embroidered tablecloth that Gigi had purchased during her ill-fated visit to Copenhagen. "That he is here in England, living in your house, being civil to you, persuading you to come with him to see me, all this, does it not mean anything to you? Does it have to be stated in so many words, or carved on a stone tablet, for heaven's sake?" Was it not enough that she had to struggle with it by herself? She didn't need to hear it spelled out item by item by her mother, as if she were a dimwit chit from some Oscar Wilde play. "Mother, you forget why he's here in the first place," she said coolly. "We are divorcing. I have pledged my hand to Lord Frederick." Mrs. Rowland rose abruptly. "I will rest for a short while. It would not do for me to appear haggard before his grace. But if you think that you love Lord Frederick a fraction as much as you love, not loved, but love, Tremaine, then you're a greater fool than any Shakespeare ever wrote." Gigi remained in the parlour long after Mrs. Rowland had swept out, trailing a faint wake of rose attar behind her. Slowly, absently, she finished the cream cake Mrs. Rowland had left behind, as well as the two small jam tarts that still remained on the three-tiered platter. If only she could be certain that her mother was dead wrong. Chapter 22. The Duke, upon first glance, did not appear either a scholar or a reprobate. No book dust or buxom doxies clung to him. But he was certainly imposing, as an aristocrat of the highest rank, with none of the "golly, would you believe my good luck" mellowness that characterised the current Duke of Fairford, her father-in-law. No, this was a man born to lord over lesser beings, and who'd done it authoritatively for the entirety of his adult life. A man who could cow half of society into hushed awe with his sheer ducalness. Gigi was not immediately impressed. Despite an upbringing focused exclusively on becoming a duchess, she seemed to have inherited a democratic streak from her plebeian ancestors. "Good evening, Your Grace."
"Lady Tremaine, you've decided to join us after all."
His corresponding wry amusement made it evident that he was not without a clue as to the purpose behind the dinner. The surprise was her mother, who did not have a democratic bone in her body. Gigi would have expected some reverence on her part, and triumph that she'd finally manoeuvred Gigi and the Duke into the same room. But Mrs. Rowland's demeanour was rather one of grim determination, as if she were on a mission to Greenland, a gruelling journey with nothing but barrenness at the end. Equally intriguing was the Duke's deportment toward Mrs. Rowland. A man such as he did not know how to be nice. He probably tolerated his friends and treated everyone else with condescension. Yet, as he complimented Mrs. Rowland on her flower arrangements, he displayed a solicitude and a delicacy Gigi hadn't sensed in him before. Camden arrived late, his hair still slightly damp from his bath. He'd returned from the seashore only 30 minutes ago. "May I present my son-in-law, Lord Tremaine?" said Mrs. Rowland, in a rare bit of archness. "Lord Tremaine, His Grace the Duke of Perrin."
"A pleasure, Your Grace," said Camden.
Despite his hurried toilette, he seemed more settled into the role of affable, oblivious host than anyone else.
"I've had the pleasure of reading 11 Years Before Ilium, a most illuminating work."
The Duke raised one black brow.
"I had no idea my modest monographs could be found in America."
"As to that, I wouldn't know either. I received a copy from my esteemed mother-in-law when she was in London last." The Duke turned his monocled gaze to Mrs. Rowland. He'd have resembled a Punch caricature if it weren't for his commanding presence and his sardonic self-awareness. Mrs. Rowland shifted her weight from one foot to the other, then back again. Gigi's eyes widened. The men in the parlour might not understand the significance of that seemingly unremarkable motion, but Gigi knew that Mrs. Rowland never fidgeted. She could hold as still as a caryatid, and for about as long.
"My mother is a learned acolyte of the blind bard," said Gigi. "You will find few women, or men for that matter, sir, more thoroughly knowledgeable concerning all things Homeric."
This revelation startled the Duke again, in a way that felt more complicated than simply a man's surprise that a woman would know something in his field of expertise. He inclined his head in Mrs. Rowland's direction.
"My compliments, madam. You must tell me how you came to develop a passion for my arcane subjects."
Mrs. Rowland's response was a high castle wall of a smile. Camden glanced Gigi's way. Apparently she wasn't the only one to have noticed something highly irregular. Hollis announced that dinner awaited. Mrs. Rowland, with almost obvious relief, suggested that they pair off and proceed to the dining room. For Victoria, about the only silver lining to the cumbersome evening was that the Duke didn't immediately succumb to Gigi's charms. She'd fretted about Gigi's looks throughout her daughter's childhood, as the child stubbornly refused to blossom into the kind of flawless beauty Victoria had been, but instead grew unfashionably tall, with wide shoulders and a challenging gaze that was Victoria's despair. Then, a few years ago, after Victoria at last realized she no longer needed to train her eyes on the girl's gown and coiffure for signs of imperfection, she noticed something quite confounding. Men stared at Gigi. Some of them gawked. At balls and soirees, they had their eyes glued to her as she walked, talked, and occasionally, largely with indifference, glanced their way. When Victoria mentally distanced herself and studied her daughter as a stranger would, she was shocked to realize just how obscenely attractive Gigi might be to the masculine sex. She had no words to describe the kind of primal allure Gigi exuded, an incandescent sensuality that surely didn't come from Victoria. It made Victoria feel old, past her prime, her vaunted beauty a distant second place to Gigi's youth, luminosity, and glamour. Gigi looked as well as she ever did, in a dinner gown of vermilion velvet, the skin of her throat and arms glowing in the lambent light like that of a Bouguereau nymph. The Duke spoke to Gigi as he ought to, making the obligatory grunts concerning the relative proportion of precipitation to sunshine in recent days in both London and Devon. But unlike Gigi's husband, who glanced at her over his wineglass with every other forkful, Perrin kept most of his attention on the plate before him, gravely tasting the successive courses of soupe d'ossée, filet de sole à la Normandie, and duck à la Rouennaise.
"Allow me to compliment you, madam, on your chef,"
the Duke suddenly looked up and said.
"The food is nowhere near as terrible as I expected."
Victoria was absurdly pleased. Ever since the night when they'd gambled over chocolates, and she'd practically told him to drag her upstairs and ravish her lonely old bones, she'd been on pins and needles. She could repeat to herself only so many times that, in desperate embarrassment at being found out, she'd made up the whole thing on the spot. The only problem was that she was a terrible impromptu liar. Without hours and days of prior preparation, she either blurted out the truth or bungled so badly the odour of her mendacity could be scented a furlong away. Had she told the inadvertent truth instead? Was this whole exercise in folly simply an opening for her to grab the Duke by his lapels and make him take notice of her at long last? He hadn't entirely believed her, but he didn't disbelieve her enough. There was something about truth, the visceral ferocity of it, that seeped under and around incredulity, no matter how well-founded and watertight. "Thank you," she said, "though I cannot return the compliment on your tact."
"Tact is for others, madam."
As if to underscore his point, he glanced at Gigi and Camden and said,
"Forgive the curiosity of a dotard who retired from society many years ago, but is it commonplace nowadays for a couple about to divorce to be on such apparently friendly terms?"
"Quite so," answered Camden, his tone as smooth and creamy as a dish of flan. He looked at Gigi.
"Wouldn't you say, my dear?"
"Without a doubt," said Gigi dryly. "We do loathe scenes, don't we, Tremaine?" Even the Duke was left momentarily speechless by this bravura performance. He moved on to a safer topic.
"I understand you've got quite the Midas touch, Lord Tremaine."
"Hardly, sir. It's Lady Tremaine who has the head for business. I but try my best to reach financial parity with her." Victoria glanced at Gigi, hoping she'd heard the admiration in Camden's words, but the quick shadow of confusion in Gigi's eyes suggested that she heard something else instead.
"I'd always thought it otherwise," said Victoria. "Lady Tremaine builds upon the success of her forefathers, but you started with nothing."
"I wouldn't say so, madam. I'm no Horatio Alger, hero beloved of the American imagination," replied Camden. "My first acquisitions were made with substantial loans obtained against Lady Tremaine's inheritance."
Gigi choked on her wine. She coughed into her napkin as Hollis rushed to her side with a fresh napkin and a goblet of water. She took a long draught of water and promptly resumed her ingestion of the slices of duck on her plate. Victoria took it upon herself to ask the question that Gigi didn't.
"I had no idea. How were you able to do that?"
Camden, like his cousin before him, had signed a marriage contract that prohibited any direct access to Gigi's fortune.
"I proved to them who I was and who she was. I had the marriage papers and the announcement from the Times. The Bank of New York decided quite on its own that my wife would come to my rescue should I be in danger of defaulting," he said, his smile subtly feral.
Good grief. Dazzled by his polish and finesse, Victoria had never observed this brazen side to her son-in-law.
She'd always thought the once-upon-a-time affection and friendship between the calculating heiress and the urbane marquis endearing but odd, as the two could not be more different one from the other. How she'd underestimated Camden by equating his burnish of faultless manners with a lack of inner ferocity. The Duke took an appreciative sip of his burgundy, a 14-year-old Romanée Conti. Victoria was rather shocked to see that he was smiling a little. He was not classically handsome, his features more rough-hewn than refined, with unruly brows and a Mont Blanc of the nose, a face that lent itself easily to terrifying scowls. But his smile, a slight, underdeveloped one at that, was utterly transforming. It illuminated his fine chestnut-brown eyes, animated his lips, and melted his hauteur with surprising warmth and earthy machismo. She did not use the word lightly. In fact, she'd never applied it to any living man. But he looked nigh on irresistible. Suddenly she saw why otherwise properly reared ladies fought over him like harpies. "There are few things I loathe more than small country dinners," he said. "But, madam, had you only informed me that such remarkable diversion lay in store for me, I would not have compelled you to provide additional entertainment." A moment of absolute silence. Victoria was too disoriented to feel embarrassed. She hadn't yet grasped that the focus of the conversation had abruptly shifted from the Tremaines to her dealings with the Duke. "Dear sir," said Gigi wryly, "pray do tell." "Oh, Gigi, please, none of that unseemly interest," Victoria huffed. "His Grace but requested that I play a few hands of cards with him, which I gladly obliged." "Sir," Gigi addressed the Duke, a sly smile on her face, "I have heard that you are a scoundrel. I see you are at least a rascal." "Gigi!" Victoria cried, mortified. But the Duke seemed amused rather than offended. "I was a scoundrel in my youth, to put it kindly. As for my rascally demands, let's just say I could have stipulated a great deal more and still received compliance." Victoria felt her face flame a colour as bright as Gigi's gown. Oh, how she hated to blush in public! So inelegant and infantile! Camden, bless him, was eating with gluttonous zest, as if he hadn't heard a word of the conversation in the last 5 minutes. Gigi, taking a cue from her husband, gave the remaining slice of duck breast on her plate another good poke. The Duke, however, wasn't done. "Young lady," he addressed Gigi, "I hope you realise how fortunate you are, at your age, to still have a mother who would dance with the devil for you." It was Camden's turn to cough into his napkin, though in his case it sounded more like choked laughter than actual choking. The dinner, up to that point a parody, if a rather barbed one, was now a farce. She'd thought the whole dinner to be a bad idea for a while now, hadn't she? Thought Victoria wildly. Why, oh, why hadn't she called it off? Why had she persisted, as if the Duke were Moby Dick, and she the crazed Captain Ahab, who would either harpoon him or die trying? Gigi was not one to take lectures sitting down. "Sir, I hope you realise that while I am eminently grateful, I have also reminded my mother, pointedly, that no dancing with the devil is necessary on my behalf. I already have the affection and the fealty of a good man. My future happiness after my divorce is already assured." The Duke sighed exaggeratedly. "Lady Tremaine, I do not profess to know the marvellous qualities of this other man, but why wage and waste a divorce
when it's more than evident to me that you and your husband haven't even tired of each other yet.
Having silenced Gigi and strangled Camden's mirth, His Grace turned to Victoria and smiled again, a full smile this time. She nearly melted into her chair, leaving nothing behind but a whalebone corset and an assemblage of skirts.
Madam, he raised his glass in a toast, this is the most sublime Burgundy it has ever been my privilege to enjoy. You may be assured of my everlasting gratitude.
Chapter 23 The silence of a house settling into the night was first disturbed as Camden stood brushing his teeth over a basin of water. Then came a loud crash to his left, a heavy vibration that travelled up his ankles to his knees, followed by a muffled shriek. The cottage had 6 bedchambers upstairs, Mrs. Rowland's at the eastern corner, and 5 others, of southern exposure, lined in a row. Camden was in the chamber closest to Mrs. Rowland's, and Gigi in the one furthest away. The shriek came from Gigi's direction. He spat the tooth powder out of his mouth and pulled open the door. Mrs. Rowland's door opened a second later.
"Good heavens! What was that?" she cried.
"The ceiling, probably," he said.
Gigi, too, was in the hallway, her face very pale against the midnight blue of her peignoir.
"What's the matter with your house?" she said tightly to her mother.
Camden began opening doors. The room next to his seemed fine, except that several pictures had fallen off the wall. He opened the door to the middle chamber. A gust of debris greeted him. Almost the entire ceiling had collapsed, blanketing the floor and the furniture in dust-ridden chunks of plaster and timber. Above him gaped the cavernous void of the attic.
"Good heavens! How did this happen?" Mrs. Rowland moaned. "This is a most sturdy house."
"I don't think anyone should sleep on this floor until the ceiling is repaired and the integrity of the entire structure inspected," said Camden.
"You and I can share the governess's room on the ground floor," said Gigi to Mrs. Rowland. "Do you have a spare cot for Camden?"
"Nonsense," cried Mrs. Rowland. "Lord Tremaine is a first-time visitor to this house. I will not have him spend the night on a cot in the parlour like hired help.
I will ask to be put up at Mrs. Morland's cottage down the lane. She has 2 daughters who visit her, so she always has a spare chamber made up. You and Camden take the governess's room."
"I will take the cot and sleep in the parlour," said Gigi. "I'm not a first-time visitor. It doesn't matter where I sleep. Or I can come with you to Mrs. Morland's."
"Absolutely not to either of your mad propositions," Mrs. Rowland recoiled in grandiose horror. "I will not have that kind of gossip bandied about. The 2 of you may divorce up a storm in London, but here I have my reputation to consider. I will not have people asking why my daughter wouldn't share a room with her lawfully wedded husband. There, I think I hear Hollis coming up. I will confer with him about the arrangements. Mind that you do nothing to embarrass me, Gigi. No cots whatsoever."
After Mrs. Rowland hurried down the steps with surprising energy and bounce, Gigi cursed under her breath.
"Arrangements, my foot," she said, her voice seething. "She arranged for the ceiling to cave in. This house was inspected from top to bottom only a year ago because I was worried that it might be getting a bit decrepit. It is sound. Ceilings in sound structures do not just fall in like that, and certainly not so beautifully, exactly in an unoccupied room so that nobody gets hurt."
"We've underestimated your mother's determination."
"She should be having an affair with the Duke. That's what she should be doing," Gigi huffed. "Look at her. She's sacrificing the roof over her head to herd us into the same bedchamber when we already... never mind."
Camden felt his heart beginning to pound.
He hadn't planned on paying Gigi a conjugal visit, this being Mrs. Rowland's house and all, but if they were going to be stuck in the same, and chances were, fairly cramped room, and forced to share a bed, well... "Do you have anything that needs to be carried?" he asked. She shot him a suspicious glance, but in the light spilling out from all the open doors, he noticed she was no longer as pale as she'd been a minute ago. "No, thank you. You go on." He went down the stairs. Hollis showed him to the governess's room. Camden found himself in a chamber both larger and prettier than the one he'd been given, its walls covered in a cream damask with elegant persimmon and moss arabesque patterns. Pink and white ranunculus in painted Limoges vases stood on each nightstand. The bed itself was quite large, the white summer bed linen already invitingly turned down. "Mrs. Rowland uses this chamber for afternoon repose in the summer," Hollis informed him. "It is cooler than the upstairs chambers." Camden turned off the lamps and opened the window shutters. Night air wafted in, cool, moist, and heavy with the scent of honeysuckle. A waxing moon was on the climb, its light pale and lucid. He discarded his robe, and, after a brief hesitation, who was he trying to fool? Napoleon wanted Russia less badly than he wanted to lie with her. He removed the rest of his clothing, too. Gigi came only after a good quarter hour. Her footsteps stopped outside the door. Then nothing happened. The silence unfolded and unrolled, shrouding him in its oppressive strata, chafing at his patience and nerves. The doorknob finally turned, softly. She closed the door behind her, but advanced no further, standing with her back against it, her feet just beyond the imprint of moonlight. He was reminded of a night long ago, in a different house that also belonged to Mrs. Rowland, where a similarly lustrous moon also silvered a long swath of the room. The beginning of the end. The end of the beginning. "Like old times, isn't it?" he said, after a full minute had passed. More silence. "What do you mean?" she said at last, her voice slightly creaky. "Don't tell me you've forgotten." She shifted, barely audible sounds of silk sliding on flesh and against the panels of the door.
"So you were awake," she said accusatorily.
"I'm a light sleeper, and I was on an unfamiliar bed in an unfamiliar house."
"You took advantage of me," he chuckled.
"What did you expect after you felt me up and down? I could have done more, and you'd have let me."
"I could have done more, too. I almost climbed back into your bed that night. Would have been a short path to the altar."
"You don't say," he murmured. "What stopped you?"
"I thought it was dishonorable. Something beneath me."
"Ironic, isn't it?"
She pushed away from the door and advanced until she stood by the bed, on the farther side from him, her silhouette limned against a nimbus of moonlight, the dark curves of her body just barely visible inside the diaphanous shadows of her peignoir. He swallowed.
"I should have gone ahead and done it that night," she said. "You'd have married me, knowing you'd been had. But you wouldn't have been infuriated enough to run to America, only disgusted enough to not be happy with me. We'd have been like every other couple in society. The normal life, you see."
"No," he said, his voice harsher than he'd intended. "You should have done the honourable thing. Theodora married one day before we did. Had you a little more patience, when I returned to England for Easter, you could have had your cake and eaten it too."
The bed dipped beneath her weight. She slid under the covers, safely on her side of the bed.
"I think I've learned my lesson already."
"Have you?"
She didn't answer. Instead, she asked a question of her own. Why do you place so much importance on reaching financial parity with me? He thought, because I am married to you, the richest woman in England after Victoria Regina, you idiot. What's a man who still dreams of fucking you to do? He reached under the cover, grabbed her by the front of her peignoir, and yanked her toward him. She gasped, and gasped again as his teeth scraped the crook of her neck. He rolled on top of her, groaning with the heaviness of her under him. Since his return, he'd seen her naked, he'd climaxed inside her, but he'd not allowed himself to feel her, the dense, smooth texture of her skin, the firm undulation of her body. He grabbed a fistful of her peignoir and pushed it upward. Take it off! No, you can do what you want perfectly well with it in place. What I want is you naked, without a stitch. That wasn't part of our deal. You never said I had to disrobe for you. What's the matter? He said softly into her ear, enjoying her quiver. Afraid to be naked under me? It's not right. I'm not going to dishonour Freddy by allowing you any more liberties than I must. Suddenly he was enraged at her obduracy and her obtuseness. Lord Frederick would make her about as happy as a clam in a bowl of bouillabaisse. He gripped her peignoir at her throat and tore it down its length, the shrill sound rudely rending the somnolent darkness. There! Now if Lord Frederick asks, which is none of his business, you can tell him in all honesty that you didn't allow me any liberties. She panted, the sound of a woman unable to get enough air, her exhalations drowning out the muffled chirping of sleepless crickets in the garden. He lowered himself onto her, the sensation of her skin against his, at once shockingly familiar and unnervingly new, as if he'd never left her bed all these years, as if this was only the second night of their honeymoon, and he'd been staring at her all day, dying for the sun to set and a blessed endless night to descend. He was a fool to fall for her the first time, and a fool to come back now, when he already knew his weakness all too well, having wrestled with it every day of these past 10 years. Too late. He drowned himself in the velvety feel of her, marvelling at the way her skin slid over her clavicles with her every breath, kissing a trail along the top of her shoulder, reluctant to leave each square inch of her glorious skin, impatient to savour all of her. She placed her hands against his upper arms, but she didn't push. She only emitted a sweet, despairing sound as he kissed the base of her throat. The gloom in his heart lifted a bit, though he knew it was madness to think this was anything but madness. He kissed his way to her chin, to the soft spot just under her lips. There he hesitated. To kiss her on the mouth was to inform her, in exactly so many words, that she'd marry Lord Frederick over his dead body. Beneath him, he felt her heartbeat, as rapid, erratic, and uncertain as his own. Did he want to go down that path? Did he dare? And what awaited him at the bitter end if he were to walk this avenue of folly? "There's something I have to tell you," she said suddenly, rupturing the moment of suspense. "There's no point to your sleeping with me. None at all. I'm using a Dutch cap. I have been using one all along. You stand no chance of getting me with child, so you might as well leave me alone." When he was 6 years old, during an exuberant game of chase in the corridors of his grandfather's house, he'd run into a wall. The next thing he knew, he found himself flat on the floor, too stunned to understand what had just happened. He felt like that now. He didn't know what to make of her outburst, her abrupt decision to push things to the brink. He gazed down at her. Her features were only half visible in the faint illumination of the moon. a shadow of a high cheekbone, a dark fullness of lips, and eyes like water at the bottom of a deep well, black with pinpoints of refracted starlight. Then why do you tell me? Why not go on duping me? That would have served your purpose better.
Because I can't take it any more, she said, lying very still. I'm sure you are happily vindicated in your opinion of me, but it doesn't matter. I can't go any further.
Why? He ran his fingers through her hair, the ultimate luxury. Her hair was heavy, smooth, glossy, and cool as morning dew. He never remembered another woman's hair the way he remembered hers.
What happened to your legendary ruthlessness?
She closed her eyes and turned her face away from him. His fingers felt ridiculously comforting against her skull. They moved with reassuring gentleness, coming to rest for a moment next to her temple, then sliding lower along her ear, her jaw, and finally her lips. The pad of his thumb skimmed over her bottom lip, rolled it down slightly so that he touched the moist membrane just inside her mouth. His reaction confused her. She wanted to ask him, loudly, whether he'd heard anything she'd said, that she hadn't changed, hadn't learned her lesson at all, and had tried to deceive him again. But his touch hypnotized her. It was warm, curious, and utterly without rancor. She couldn't speak. She was all awareness, all deprived, hungry, unbearably keen awareness. He kissed the lobe of her ear, the bone that hinged her jaw, the tip of her chin. He kissed her neck, her shoulder, and the indentation of her clavicle. She kept her eyes tightly shut. In that absolute darkness, he was all heat and sensation to her, his lips a source of cool fire that burned everything they touched, spawning jolts of desire that spiked through her body, leaving her mindless and weak. Suddenly his mouth closed around her nipple. She gasped, a flabbergasted sound of pleasure. He licked her. She wanted to thrash and gyrate and beg for more. Her nails dug into the counterpane. His hand found her other nipple and rubbed it between his thumb and forefinger. With just enough force to make her abandon all efforts at quietness, she moaned out loud. His hand moved lower, down her side, coming to rest a fraction of a second against her hip, and then on to pry her legs apart. She made a feeble attempt to keep them together, but he had only to swirl his tongue slowly once around her nipple for her to forget everything. He found her, probably the easiest thing in the world. He but had to go to the source of her wetness. And then his finger, no fingers, were inside her. "Tell me to stop, and I will," he said, just before he took her other nipple into his mouth. Somewhere in the back of her mind, she realized what he was doing, dislodging and removing the Dutch cap. She might have objected, had she been capable of coherent speech, but she wasn't, and the only sounds she admitted were choked whimpers of arousal. He easily extracted the Dutch cap from her and tossed it to the side of the bed. She shivered. "Now there's nothing between us," he said. A sudden flash of terror paralyzed her. She was utterly exposed to him, her womb, her future, her entire life. And just as suddenly, an overwhelming swell of desire inundated her. She wanted him inside her, to possess her, to shatter her, to fill every emptiness and destroy every defense. With a moan of despair, she grabbed hold of him and pulled him down to her, kissing him so hard that their teeth banged and ground together. He pulled away slightly, restrained her face between his hands, and kissed her his way, slower, more gently, and much more thoroughly.
She opened her legs wide, and he came into her, thick and hot, as he kissed her. She wrapped her legs about him, urging him, wanting something fast, furious, and utterly obliterating. But in that, he refused to oblige her. He tormented her with long, slow strokes, teasing her nipples as he drove into her at a leisurely pace. He made her beg for each delicious thrust. He made her thrash and gyrate and wail and whimper. And only when she was wholly vanquished, desperate, convinced that she would exist forever in this state of trembling, feverish arousal, only then did he give in and pummel her to her incoherent, wild, joyous, and vocal satisfaction. If only she could make time stand still. If only she need never depart the warmth of his embrace and the euphoria of their lovemaking. If only her world consisted of just this one dark room, drenched in the sweet muskiness of sex, protected from tomorrow and the day after tomorrow by impregnable walls of forever night. Were she to have a guinea for every if only of her life, she could pave a highway of gold from Liverpool to Newfoundland. His breath still quick and erratic, her husband pulled away from her to lie on his back, not quite touching her. She bit her lower lip, the cold, clammy tentacles of reality already creeping up her limbs toward her heart. He would not say anything unkind, but his silence was enough to remind her of everything she'd vowed never to do when he first returned. And all her declarations of love for Freddy, were they no more than words, and empty words at that? "I called on you at your hotel in Copenhagen," he said. It took her an entire minute to decipher what he'd said, and even then she didn't understand. You didn't leave a card?
You'd already left for the Margrethe.
A blaze of elation swallowed her, only to be replaced by a bleak disbelief, an impotent amazement at fate's capriciousness. I didn't catch the Margrethe, she said, dazed. It had already sailed when I arrived at the harbour.
What?
She'd never heard him say what before. He was too perfect for that. He'd never failed to use the more correct and more polite pardon, up until this moment.
Where did you go, then?
Back to the same hotel. I left only the next day. He laughed with bitter incredulity.
Did the hotel clerk not tell you that a fool came for you with flowers?
It was like finding out she was with child, then bleeding all over the place 3 weeks later, only it was happening all in one searing moment. The day clerk must have been gone by the time I decided I needed a place to stay for the night. He'd come for her. For whatever reason, he'd come for her. And they'd missed each other, as if Shakespeare himself had scripted their story on a day of particular misanthropy.
What flowers did you bring? She asked, because she couldn't think of anything else to say.
Some.
His voice faltered, something else she'd never heard from him.
Some blue hydrangeas. They were already wilted.
Blue hydrangeas, her favourite. Suddenly she felt like crying. I wouldn't have minded, she kept talking, to keep the tears at bay. I was so upset, I went to Felix as soon as I came ashore in England, only to find out he'd gotten married during the time I was away. I made a fool and a nuisance of myself anyway.
He made a sound halfway between a snort and a grunt. I almost hate to ask.
You've nothing to worry about. He didn't succumb to my advances. I came to my senses. End of story.
I came to my senses, too, after a while, he said slowly. I convinced myself that what was done between us could not be undone, could never be undone.
And there is no such thing as a fresh start.
Not really, she concurred, her tears welling, the room a dark blur. For the first time in her life, she saw exactly what she'd thrown away when she decided to have him by means fair or foul. For the very first time, she truly understood, deep in her bones, that she'd not saved him, but wronged him by consigning to him all the ability of a box turtle to make his own choices. She had been, just as she hadn't wanted to admit, impetuous, short-sighted, and selfish. I should not have done what I did. I'm sorry.
I wasn't exactly a paragon of rectitude myself, was I? I should have had the frankness to confront you, however unhappy that encounter would have been. Instead, I retreated to subterfuge and confused vengeance with justice.
She laughed bitterly. For two intelligent people, they'd certainly made all the wrong choices that could have been made, and then some.
I wish...
She stopped herself. What was the point? They'd missed their chance already.
I wish the same. That I'd caught you that day, somehow.
He sighed, a heavy sound of regret. He turned toward her and turned her toward him, his hand clasped firmly on her upper arm.
But it's still not too late.
For a long moment she didn't understand him. Then a thunderbolt crashed atop her, leaving her blind and staggered. There'd been a time in her life when she'd have walked barefoot over a mile of broken glass for a reconciliation with him, when she'd have expired from joy upon hearing those exact same words. That time was years and years ago, long past. Her imbecilic heart, however, still leapt and burst and rolled around in clumsy cartwheels of jubilation, right into a wall. She was promised to Freddy. Freddy, who trusted her unconditionally, who adored her far more than she deserved. She'd reaffirmed her desire and determination to marry him every time she'd met him, the last time only 2 days before. How could she possibly slap Freddy with such a gross betrayal?
I tried not to, said Camden, his eyes the most brilliant pinpoints of light in the night. But all too often I wondered what might have happened, back in 88, had I not given up, had I the nerve to come look for you in England.
Why didn't you? She cried silently. Why didn't you come for me when I was lonely and heartsick? Why did you wait until I'd committed myself to another man?
She covered her eyes, but her head was still Babel and Bedlam, feral thoughts cannibalizing each other, emotions in a pandemonium of roundhouse and fisticuff. Then suddenly a siren song arose above the din, sweet and irresistible, and she could hear nothing else. A new beginning, a new beginning, a new beginning, a new spring after the dead of winter. A phoenix arising from its own ashes, the magical second chance that had always eluded her futile quests, now presented to her on a platter of gold, on a bed of rose petals. She had but to reach out and...
It was this very same insatiable craving for him that had overcome her a decade ago. This very same impulse to damn everything and everyone else. She'd surrendered her principles and acted out of expediency and untrammeled self-interest. And look what had happened. At the end of the day, she'd had neither self-respect nor happiness. But the siren song descanted more beautifully still. Remember how you giggled and prated together about everything and nothing? Remember the plans you made to hike the Alps and sail the Riviera?
Remember the hammock you were going to crowd in warmer weathers, the two of you side by side, with creases stretched atop the both of you? No, those were mirages, memories and wishes distorted through rose-tinged lenses. Her future lay with Freddy. Freddy, who did not deserve to be ignominiously cast aside, who deserved the best she had to give, not the worst. He had entrusted his entire happiness to her. She couldn't live with herself were she to trifle with that trust. What about... No. If she must endure the siren song, like Odysseus, thrashing and flailing in temptation, then she would. But she would not abandon Freddy, nor her own decency. Not this time, not ever again. She looked at Camden. I can't, she said, her voice barely above a whisper. I'm pledged to another. His fingers on her arm tightened infinitesimally. Then the coolness of the night replaced the warmth of his hand. His eyes didn't leave hers, but she could no longer see the light in them. Only an infinite darkness met her gaze. Why did you tell me about the Dutch cap, exactly?
Why, exactly?
I was... If there was a riding crop nearby, she'd gladly have used it on herself. I thought you'd be so disgusted you wouldn't want anything more to do with me.
I see. Preserving your loyalty to Lord Frederick still.
His voice had gone chill, as had her heart. A frozen expanse, except for one white flame of anguish.
Why, then, did you not object when I exposed you to a very real risk of consequences?
And what could she say? That she'd ever been so? That he had but to display the slightest sweetness and approval for her to forget everything otherwise important? That she was a hopeless imbecile in his bed?
I wasn't thinking. I'm sorry.
The bed creaked. For a fleeting second, she saw the deep channel of his back as he sat with his hands braced to either side of him, his head bent. Then he left the bed altogether.
I wish you'd have remembered all those scruples a little sooner, he said, a current of anger churning beneath his seamless politeness.
He shrugged into his dressing gown and tightened the sash in a savage motion. She sat up, clutching the bedspread against her chest.
Stay, she wanted to say. Stay with me. Do not leave.
Instead, she mumbled in arrant daftness.
You said yourself that what happened between us cannot be undone, can never be undone.
And would that I had heeded my own sage advice, he said curtly, marching toward the door.
Wait, she cried. Where are you going? The rooms upstairs aren't safe. You don't know what other damages could have been done.
I'll take my chances, he said. There's bound to be a bed in this house that's less dangerous than yours.
Camden lay abed in the chamber that had been first assigned to him. He stared at the ceiling and half wished it would collapse on him and knock him senseless. Not that he had a full implement of sense left.
I wasn't thinking, she'd said.
She most certainly wasn't alone in it. He probably hadn't had a properly lucid day since the first letter from her solicitors arrived the previous September, requesting an annulment. He'd long referred to his marriage as that tolerable state of being. Tolerable because as long as the legalities were ironclad and ineluctable, she was still wedded to him, with a chance that one day, in a faraway, golden-misted future, they might yet rise above their youthful Sturm und Drang and achieve some sort of passable happiness. Not that he willingly admitted any such wishful thinking to himself, but 14-hour working days translated into nights too weary for self-censorship.
When she moved to officially dissolve their marriage, with flocks of letters from her lawyers darkening the sky like so many swarms of Egyptian locusts, the stasis on which he depended descended into chaotic disequilibrium. He found himself a stunned observer, unable to do anything other than toss the letters into the fireplace with increasing grimness and alarm. Annulment was one thing. Divorce, however, quite another. When she'd actually gone ahead and petitioned for divorce, he'd been jolted with wrath, a massacre the peasants and salt the earth, blood rage. This marriage was their devil's pact, begun in lies and sealed in spite. How dare she try to break free of this chain of acrimony that bound them? Neither of them deserved any better. How injudicious he'd been to not understand the eruption of years of pent-up frustration, and how blind, when he'd calmed down during the Atlantic crossing, to think that he'd arrived at a reasonable, mature solution in his demand for an heir as a condition for releasing her from their marriage. All he'd achieved was the unleashing of the beastly attraction that had taken him years to tame. But whereas once the beast had devoured her, this time it consumed him. He didn't know whether it was courage or madness that made him ask her outright to not throw away everything they'd ever had. He only knew the black pain of her rejection, a sense of loss through which he could barely breathe. Somehow he couldn't believe that this was it, that their story would end with such wretchedness, as if Hansel and Gretel had become the witch's dinner after all, or Sleeping Beauty's prince a pile of gnawed bones in the enchanted forest. But her voice, though barely audible, had been firm and clear. She might cling and writhe beneath him, and lose her head momentarily, but she kept her larger goal firmly in sight, and that goal was to sever all ties with him. Perhaps she was right. Perhaps he was still stuck in 1883. Perhaps this was indeed how their story would end. She as another man's radiant bride, and he but a dusty footnote in the annals of her history. She was in the dining room, staring at an already cold cup of tea, when he appeared at her side, in riding gear, his hair windblown. "I imagine we should know in a few weeks whether there will be consequences from our action last night," he said without preamble. "I imagine so." She looked back to her tea, all too aware of his presence, of the scent of morning mist still clinging to him, and already panicking over what news the end of her cycle might bring, either way. "If there aren't any consequences, would you let me go to Freddy?"
"And if there are, would you still insist on marrying him?"
"If there are," she pushed the words out past the lump in her throat, "I would hold up my end of the bargain, and I should like you to honour your part of it." In response, he chortled softly, a sound without warmth or emotions. He took her chin in hand and slowly tilted her face so that she was forced to look at him.
"I hope Lord Frederick does not live to regret his choice," he said. "Your love is a terrible thing."
Chapter 24. The 5th of June, 1893.
"No, no, it won't do. Get me the green one instead," said Langford.
He unbuttoned the claret-coloured waistcoat, the third he'd rejected, and handed it back to his valet. A scowling, middle-aged man stared back at him in the mirror. He'd never been exactly handsome, but in his prime he'd been quite something to behold, always impeccably coiffed and garbed, always with the most desirable women of the upper echelon draped over his arms. 15 years in the country, and suddenly he was a bumpkin. His clothes were a decade out of fashion. He'd forgotten how to pomade his hair, and he was fairly certain that he no longer remembered how to seduce a woman. Seduction was a matter of mind. A man 100% certain of himself had women eating out of his hand. A man 80% certain of himself had only pigeons eating out of his hand. And this 80% man, for reasons listed only on the devil's tail, had invited Mrs. Rowland to tea. Tea! As if he were some fluttery little old lady looking forward to a bit of crumpet and gossip. Or, worse, as if he were some sentimental sap seeking to turn back the clock 30 years. His valet returned with a deep green waistcoat, the colour of a densely wooded valley. Langford shrugged into it, determined to stick with this particular selection whether he looked a prince or a frog. He looked neither, just a perturbed, confounded, and slightly apprehensive man who hadn't exactly let himself go, nor exactly kept himself up. It would have to do, he supposed. Her landau pulled up before the manor at Ludlow Court at exactly 5:02. Beneath her lace parasol, she looked as dainty and prim as the Queen's own teacup. Her choice of attire, an afternoon gown of pearl and pale blue, pleased him. He liked the creams and pastels that predominated her wardrobe, colours of an eternal spring, though had someone asked him during his man-about-town days, he'd have decreed such hues much too pedestrian. He welcomed her himself, presenting his ungloved hand for her support as she alit from the carriage. She was both pleased and somewhat nonplussed. Good, that made two of them. "I called on you a few weeks ago, Your Grace," she said, half coyly, half challengingly. "You were not home." They both knew he'd been home, but only he knew that he'd watched her from the window of an upper floor in a mixture of exasperation and fascination. "Shall we to tea?" he said, offering his arm. By ducal standards, Ludlow Court was more than modest. It was downright humble. A long time ago, in his 20s, Langford had been invited to Blenheim Palace. As his carriage approached that great edifice from a distance, he'd been consumed by an overwhelming sense of inadequacy. Compared to the colossus that was the Marlborough's ancestral estate, his own seat seemed merely a glorified vicar's cottage. Blenheim Palace's facade of grandeur, however, quickly proved just that, a facade, or, to be more precise, an illusion, for as his conveyance drew near to the house, the facade itself turned out to be in a state of advanced ill repair. Inside the great mansion, the curtains were moulded and full of holes, the walls dark from badly maintained flues, and the ceiling water-stained in practically every room. This after the family had sold the famed Marlborough gems to help matters. A few years after his visit, the 7th Duke had had to petition Parliament to break entail, so that the whole contents of the house could be auctioned off to defray family debts. In contrast, the manor at Ludlow Court was a jewel box, a diminutive but perfect example of Palladian architecture, with lucid, elegant lines, beautiful proportions, and an interior that Langford had been able to maintain, and occasionally update, with relative ease. But as he passed through the anteroom and the grand entrance, with Mrs. Rowland's hand barely touching his arm, he wondered what she thought of it. Her current residence might be little larger than a hunting lodge, but he understood that she'd previously lived in a much grander place, one larger than his own, and likely more modern and more lavishly furnished, given her late husband's fortune. "You've rebuilt the terrace," said Mrs. Rowland, almost as soon as they entered the south drawing-room. One side of the room overlooked the terraced slope at the rear of the house, leading down to the spread of formal, geometric gardens and the small lake beyond. Her Grace used to fret about it.
Did she?
Yet something else he didn't know about his own mother. Yes, rather. But she chose not to repair it so as not to disturb your father in his illness, Mrs. Rowland said. She was a very good woman. That he'd realized only too late. In his proud adolescent years, he'd secretly thought his mother too frumpy and countrified, possessing none of the regality and glamour befitting the consort of a prince of the realm. Her anxious love he'd borne as if it were a millstone about his neck, little suspecting that he'd be adrift without it.
She never said anything to me about it, and I fear I was too obtuse and self-occupied to guess it of her. I had it repaired only when I began giving weekend parties here.
It is very pretty, she said, gazing out the window at the exuberant apricot-gold roses blooming along the balustrade. There were roses on her wide-brimmed hat, roses confected from ribbons of pale blue grosgrain. She would have liked it.
Would you prefer to take tea on the terrace instead? He asked impulsively. It is a beautiful day without.
Yes, I would. Thank you, she said, smiling a little. He ordered a tea table set up outside under an extended awning, with a white tablecloth and a few cuttings of the roses she was just admiring set in a crystal vase.
I think it's high time I apologized, she said, as they settled into their seats, side by side on a wide angle, so that they each enjoyed an uninterrupted view of his gardens.
That is hardly necessary. I thoroughly enjoyed myself at the dinner, and found both the food and the company fascinating.
I don't doubt that, she laughed rather self-consciously. For theatre, you couldn't do much better. But I wish to apologise for my entire scheme from the very beginning, when I sent away all my servants and stranded my kitten in a tree so that I could demand your assistance.
He smiled.
I assure you, I did not participate in your scheme as an unwitting dupe. I knew what I was getting into when I agreed to be your temporary and rather churlish Sir Galahad.
She coloured. That much I've surmised, believe me, from later events. But it still behooves me to apologise for my original deceit.
Tea arrived amid much pomp and ceremony. Mrs. Rowland took both sugar and cream, the little finger of her right hand held just slightly extended, a delicate curl like a petal of oriental chrysanthemum.
As much as I approve of your acknowledgement concerning this original deceit, it's your subsequent tale that concerns me more, he said, ignoring his tea and watching her stir hers with a languid, creamy daintiness. Would you apologise for that, too?
Only if it were a blatant fabrication.
In his distraction, he took a sip of tea. He still disliked it.
Do you mean to tell me it wasn't a blatant fabrication?
She went on stirring her tea.
After much thoughtful reflection, I've decided that I don't know any more.
He cursed his curiosity and his lack of tact. A more circumspect man would not have asked the